You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 20th of September 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 324 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Donald McRae, the writer whose new book tells the story of Emile Griffith, the world champion boxer who had to shield his sexuality from the harsh spotlight of the 1960s sporting arena.
Then we'll hear from a literary heavyweight, Sebastian Faulks, about his latest novel's attempt to explore unknown corners of the human mind, while also rethinking some of the 20th century's biggest events.
And we'll meet Gavin Pretorpini, the co-founder of The Idler, whose wandering mind is looking skywards next weekend to celebrate 10 years of another of his great distractions, the Cloud Appreciation Society.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's news dreamboat. Daniel Giacopelli will be making Studio One swoon at a handsome handful of current affairs for the news look ahead. And we'll play some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly. I don't know exactly, Steve, whether normal service has been resumed, but some sort of normalcy has been resumed, right?
I mean, to a certain extent.
We're in London, the weather's shit, and I'm back from holiday. Can we say that? We've just said it.
You can.
Okay.
No, it's not. Not only is it bad weather if you've come back from a lovely Greek island, but it's just bad weather generally. It's been raining. It's been miserable.
I feel like the starring character, or at least one of Rabbit's friends and relations in Pooh Pig and the Blustery Day. Piglet and the Blustery Day, I should
say. Is that one of your favourite of all the Winnie the Pooh?
It's one of my favourites.
Is it?
I think it contains the phrase, gone out, back soon. Because he can't smell back soon. It's absolutely brilliant. Who are we looking forward to speaking to on today's programme, other than the news dreamboat, Daniel Giacopelli? I wonder if he's blushing somewhere in his news eerie as we say that.
I feel he probably is. I think he probably wrote that part of the script himself, and we probably shouldn't have read it out. But there we are.
There are many parts of that.
I'm very much looking forward to meeting Donald McRae, who is a mighty fine sports writer, a serious sports writer.
He's a bit of a hero of both of us, I think. Yeah. He's kind of one of those people. And we were saying, we know who he is, but for those of you who don't, he's got like quite a good job of knowing that he has 48 people to interview a year and then working on books.
He basically does one big sports interview a week and then, you know, writes the odd book every year or so and seems to make a nice living out of it.
If anyone's listening out there... Just saying. Shall we get on with the Monocle Weekly? Who knows what edition of the show it is? We'll just freewheel it and welcome out, like the dove from above,
cool.
It's Daniel Giacopelli. Cool.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
Short skirts, long socks, and a full facial head of hair. It's Daniel Giacopelli.
How you doing, Rob?
Very well, thank you.
Can I just check, Danny, did you get that slightly niche 90s British TV reference there before you were introduced, the dove from above?
No,
not at all, actually.
Okay, well, tough. We're not going to explain it.
People can Google it on the YouTube section of the internet.
On the Google. I'll put it on the Google.
Yeah, put it on the Google.
Shall we start?
Gmail it.
Okay, fine. Yeah.
Does that mean that?
No small talk from you this week, Danny.
I'll ping it over to you, Rob.
Okay.
Go on then, give us the news.
So a bit of hard news first, as we always do. So this weekend, big election in Greece. Actually, it's happening today. Another election in Greece. It's kind of political chaos at all times, it seems.
Last time I looked, I was in the lead. I went down really well there. And I think,
were you doing well?
I drove around, I had a megaphone on my car, it's fine.
Yeah, people don't do that enough these days, do they?
They do in Athens. Yeah, we heard no end of it.
Really?
Yeah.
Sort of driving around with a proper sort of...
Yeah, absolutely.
Vote for me, this is why.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I rather like
that. Did you understand any of it?
No. But I was with some people who did.
Okay. And were they nodding their head going...
They were shaking their head going, I don't understand it. But I don't think that... I think they could understand the language, just not the particular brand of politics.
Well, there we are. Nice to see that... Well, I mean, I guess they know how to do elections now in Greece. I mean... Democracy is a Greek word.
And
they've had a lot of recent experience.
You heard it here first.
Democracy.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, that's happening. We'll be covering that all of next week on Monocle 24. Two high profile visits this week. Xi Jinping is visiting the US, and also the Pope is visiting the US, both in this upcoming week. I wonder whether Xi Jinping will have as much fun this time as he did last time. Because when he last went there, it was when he was vice premier. He was the number two.
Right.
And so he got to hang out with Joe Biden a lot.
Yeah.
And so they went to a basketball game. What do you call it?
Jesus, come on. I've been here too long. No, nobody says match.
Game. I
mean, that's, no, okay. It's a game.
They went to the basketball.
Is Joe Biden fun? Is he a fun guy to
hang out with? I think more fun than Barack. Yeah,
right.
I'd rather hang out with Biden, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy Joe Biden. Yeah, no, he's a fun character.
Yeah.
He'll tell you stories that they'll probably go on a bit long, yeah. But, you know, he sounds like...
It'll all happen on an Amtrak train with Joe Biden.
But they had a bit of fun, basically, for 2 or 3 days, it seemed like. It was like a really bad buddy movie. This week I think it's going to be a bit more serious.
Yeah, so he's going to attend the UN General Assembly. He's going to tour Boeing. He's going to tour Microsoft. Obviously, he's going to meet with Obama. Boeing's considering setting up a factory in China. That's why he's going there. So there's that. And also the Pope. The Pope's going to be arriving at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland.
That's what he's doing. That's why he's not here. He's cracking the champagne on his own aircraft base.
Yeah, actually, the New York Times did a really good article about the Philadelphia Seminary where he's going to sleep and how they've been scrubbing the floors, washing the sheets and kind of setting it up for his arrival.
That's a good story.
You've got to kind of make an effort if the Pope's coming to town.
Yeah, they did it to three bedrooms. I don't know why they did it. Maybe the Pope will choose his favorite one or something like that.
Out of those two visits to the United States, which would make the best buddy movie and who should star in it? I'm thinking Will Ferrell and Danny McBride as the Pope and Barack Obama.
I think the Pope one would be a lot more funny than Xi Jinping.
Yeah. Who are you casting?
For the Pope?
Yeah.
Harrison Ford, I don't know.
Harrison Ford! Someone's going straight to heaven.
I'm joking. No, I just saw him
he's
in a
cool.
movie. That's why I'm
going to... No, but Harrison Ford...
Tommy Lee Jones?
No, you could make it... Oh, yeah, someone's going to hell now.
John Voight.
No. If it was Harrison Ford, you could make it a proper sort of papal action film.
Yeah, it'd be great, wouldn't it? They didn't tell me there's going to be snakes. I thought you cleaned this seminary.
None of those are actual choices, so I'm going to get letters. A lot of good events coming up next week. The Great American Beer Festival is happening in Denver.
The Pope going?
This is the largest collection of American beers ever presented in one location. 50,000 people are going. They're going to give out all kinds of crazy awards. It's kind of a craft brew mecca, if you were.
Are you?
Probably can't say that.
I was going to say it's the opposite of mecca. But very much like mecca, but with loads of alcohol. Yeah. Okay.
It's actually the opposite of mecca in every possible.
Maybe we call it Valhalla? Something like that. No one minds offending the Norse gods anymore, do they?
No, that was fine.
That's allowed. Okay. Are you a real ale fan? Are you a craft beer? America?
I am indeed, yeah.
You have the beer to go with it now.
Thanks. Yeah, I have my.
It's a craft ale
beer. My Mason cup, and I'm making not. Okay, let's move on. London Fashion Weekend is coming up to... Okay, in France, this is good.
Are we moving on from London Fashion Week?
I don't really have anything to say with that.
Okay.
Every year in France, Michelin-starred restaurants have this big kind of festival, La Fête de la Gastronomie.
Right.
Am I saying that right, Rob?
The letters, I think, were definitely there. Whether they form the right words, I don't know.
So basically, it's kind of like restaurant week. So you get a set 3-course meal at a reduced price, but it's happening all over France. So there's that happening. The Japanese Grand Prix is happening.
That's a good one. That's one of the best ones.
Because most of them are...
No, it's good. It's one of the top... It's the second best track in the whole...
Exactly. They're on proper tracks. It's not all the newfangled tracks, which are... Good. You know, designed by computers and therefore not very good.
That's good. It's a good one.
An Elvis festival is happening in Wales.
Whoa.
I'm sure it'll be. It's the largest Elvis festival in Europe.
Can you do Elvis in a Welsh accent?
I'm sure Thomas Lewis could.
It's just Tom Jones, isn't it? That is what Elvis in a Welsh accent is, Tom Jones.
Lawnmower racing, you guys into that?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Every Sunday.
Where is this happening?
The World Championships happening in East Sussex.
Late in the season.
Late in the lawnmower racing season.
Reach speeds up to 35 miles per hour. That's crazy.
These are ones that you ride.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of...
It's quite wet
on the ones that you push.
It's the last mow of the season.
And the big ones have names like Sodzilla, Turfinator, Geronimo.
Oh, man.
Oh, that was good.
Weedy Gonzalez. And the Lawn Ranger.
Really good.
Have you ever got involved in this, Rob?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of your neck of the woods.
It is your neck of the woods.
Yeah, it is. I'll be looking into this.
Lots of bushes there, yeah. Speaking of World Contraception Day, Rob, is coming up next week.
Okay.
The Awareness Day wants a future where every pregnancy is wanted. So I don't really know what they do in that day.
I don't know why you're telling me.
We've come to the end of this segment. I have a few more.
I'm fairly sure that's kind of
everyone in the control room is just stroking their temples.
They look very exasperated.
Yeah, I think
that... I actually have a few more, though.
Okay, Danny, one more.
This is actually kind of... Well, no, I'm going to actually do two more. I'm going to completely go against the one more thing. In Paris next week, there's going to be one day, and I think it's the next Sunday, so it actually... It's a week from today. They're going to ban cars from the city streets for a day to promote climate awareness. I don't know how they're actually going to execute that, but it's kind of crazy. And also, this is kind of related. Next week is when that insane event in London where they have sheep going over London Bridge.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
The Lord Mayor.
The Lord Mayor show. Yeah.
It's a bit weird. I can never quite work out what that was ever for. And why it was on the telly.
The head boy and head girl of our school had the sort of ancient right to be able to herd their sheep over London Bridge.
That's exactly what it is.
Really?
So it's
for some reason. Because their school used to be in London in like the 16th century.
The freemen of the city of London exercised their right to drive sheep across the bridge.
So does this mean that you weren't ever head boy or head girl?
I wasn't even a prefect. I was allowed to do absolutely nothing.
That's such a shame.
Well, but I still did it. It's fine. Yeah, nice.
It would have been quite nice if you'd managed to...
Have a layer of responsibility.
No, I wouldn't go that far, but be allowed to take your sheep over the bridge. So to speak. Is that sounds like a euphemism, doesn't it? Really bad
like
euphemism.
I really don't like that.
Okay, I think we really have come to the end now, Danny.
You don't want to talk about Banned Books Week, which is next week.
No. Danny Giacopelli, thank you very much for somewhat bringing us up to speed with what's happening next week.
You're welcome.
The tough and macho world of sports, particularly men's competitions, is one of the last international arenas in which sexuality, sadly, can still be something of a stumbling block. But rewind to the 1960s, and to be a gay athlete, a gay boxer at that, was unheard of.
That's what makes the story of five-time welterweight and middleweight world champion Emile Griffith so unusual. The boxer led an ambiguous life, fighting more world championship rounds than any other boxer in history, while shielding his sexuality from the public eye. When preparing for a 1962 bout at Madison Square Garden, a slur about Emile's sexuality from opponent Benny Parrott led to a ferocious reaction in the ring that left Griffith's opponents dead. It haunted him for the rest of his career. His story is now the subject of a new book from award-winning sports writer Donald McRae, A Man's World, The Double Life of Emile Griffith. And Donald joins us in the studio now to talk us through it. Welcome to the programme.
Hello,
first
thanks
of all,
for
Donald.
Having me on.
Great to have you here. And this is one of those moments of awful serendipity, I suppose, that mixes race and sexuality in one night, in a death in the ring, that is presumably the stuff of sports writers' dreams. Is this something that was long in the pipeline for you?
It has been in my head for a long time. Yeah. To keep this quite short, is initially in 1975, Emile Griffith came to South Africa. I was 14 years old then. That was when I first became aware of him, because he stood up to the apartheid government because he was fighting in Soweto. And his trainer was a white guy, and the government said a white man couldn't go into Soweto. And he said, well, the fight's off. And apartheid government gave in to him. So that was the first time I thought, wow, this is a powerful man.
Yeah.
But then I learned that he wanted to be a hat maker. He was gay. I was thinking, this is highly unusual. I've met many boxers, but never a boxer wants to be a milliner. So I just thought this is a fantastic story, even though it's quite a bleak tale as well.
And how much of that story was known already? And how much did you really have to dig around for?
The bare bones of it were known. It was known within boxing that he was a gay man, and it was obviously well known that he had killed Benny Parrott. And that fight was the first time slow motion footage had been used on television. So it was a huge event in the US. But the much more textured side of his life, living as ambivalence of being a gay athlete in 1960s New York, wasn't known. So I did a lot of work, met lots of people. I did meet Emile, but unfortunately, dementia had taken hold of him. But talking to people who've known him his whole life gave me such an insight into his world.
And it seems so different. I mean, there's a nice sort of synopsis of your book in The Guardian, in fact, which helped Steve and I do a bit of research. but we'll be taking away and thumbing right through this because it sounds like an amazing book. But, when he'd go out for fights, we mentioned in the introduction that he bought more bouts than anyone of his weight in the United States, that when he'd go out, he was kind of like cheered on in his neighborhood by the gay Hispanic community, by hookers, by drag queens.
They all loved him. And the night of that fight, someone said to me, normally Emile would stop and he'd hang out and talk talk to the hookers and the gay dancers, but that particular day he knew something dark was about to happen, and he just lifted his fist up. And the guy who told me this said it was so powerful. And then at the weigh-in, an hour later, Benny Perrette, his Cuban opponent, taunted him. And this gives us, I think, such an insight into how taboo the subject was. The New York Times journalist who was at the weigh-in decided he had to talk about the homosexual slur. He put it in his copy, but the copy editors took out that word because it was too taboo to use the word homosexual. And they used the word unman, UN-man. And this was the New York Times 50 years ago. It's kind of mind-boggling to think that's what was happening.
And it's a funny thing as well, because this is always regarded, is often regarded anyway, as like the old golden age of sports writing. No offence to anyone in this room. They were such great, big novelists would write about sport and all the rest. It's slightly different. And yet, such was the taboo around, if not race, then sexuality, that these, even the language had to be changed. Yeah. New words that mean nothing had to be invented to cover this kind of stuff.
And in a way, it allowed Emil to live this double life, because the newspapers wouldn't expose him because they couldn't talk about homosexuality. He was not able to articulate it himself and come out and say, well, I'm actually gay. So it was this double life the whole time for him.
You say that this one night, this one fight, obviously stayed with him for the rest of his life. What was the rest of his career like after that fight?
Well, he didn't want to box on, but his manager, who was actually quite a compassionate man, said, you know, there's nothing else for you. You've got to keep fighting. And yeah, unfortunately, he fought on for a dozen more years and too many fights. And this is why dementia did set in. But at the same time, he was having a party lifestyle, and there was a lot of happy moments in his life to sort of keep him going, I think.
And you mentioned that this was the first bout in which slow-mo TV footage had been used, or slow-mo cameras were used. This gives an extra moment of pathos to the replay of the dying moments, literally, of this.
Because as the fight ended, the TV guys were so excited to use their new technology. Mm. They jumped in to interview Emil, which is bog standard today with sporting events. And he knew that Benny Perrette was dying, and he was obviously in deep shock. But the slow motion footage was being shown to him, and the TV guys kept saying, commentate, tell us, what are you seeing? Look at this beautiful footage. And all he could say is, I just kept punching. I just kept punching. Which, as you say, pathos is the word, I think, for that.
We were saying before about how, you know, times have changed to a certain extent. Mm. But actually, when it comes to sport and sexuality, times haven't changed really that much, have they?
The same old taboos sort of persist. And this book sort of concludes with the first ever gay boxer who came up publicly, called Orlando Cruz, who was in 2012. I did his first ever newspaper interview. That just showed that it had taken 50 years since Emil and Benny Perrette had this fight for a boxer to come out as gay. And since then, there haven't been any other gay boxers. So I think it's still a bit of a battle.
But not just in boxing as well.
You look at
rugby,
football.
Maybe two people. Yeah. Football.
Yeah.
I mean, football, two, there's only three.
Justin Fashanu came out as gay in the early 80s and unfortunately committed suicide because I think the abuse he suffered. So yeah, there's a long, long way to go, I think.
Is your book and a character like Emil Griffith, is he poster boy for the negatives but also the positives of being fantastic at a certain sport and actually having that huge weight of, you know, this death complicated his professional career and his private life, presumably more than anything in his professional career, his private life before?
Absolutely. But I think, you know, it's quite uplifting. And I think certainly we're talking about in his own time where people who were gay or on the margins of society saw him as the idol, as someone who they could look to. And I think his life is going to continue, even though he died in 2013. I think people are beginning to understand that he left quite a legacy that I think will hopefully still be uplifting in years to come.
I want to ask more generally about sports writing and serious sports writing, the sort that you're involved in. Do you feel that this is actually quite a good time for that? Because there are, you know, there seem to be lots of good books coming out, lots of interesting publishers who are willing to take a punt on them. Magazines perhaps less so, but books certainly.
I think so, definitely. And I mean, this is my 10th book and I've done nonfiction on all kinds of subjects. But certainly sport has changed, and I think now publishers are looking for books which in sport which have much more depth to them, much more context. Of course, you're going to have the quick book on the famous footballer that'll come out. But I think there is much more of an appetite for books of substance that look beyond the surface of sport. So yes, I think it is a good time for sports writing.
Yeah, because presumably like anything else, it casts a light on the rest of the society that it exists in, like an artist would or a musician would.
Absolutely.
I mean, these are interesting people.
And I think people are fascinated by the fame and the glamour of sport. But as a writer, what is interesting is beneath that facade of fame and glamour, there's often a lot of complexity and heartache.
Mm.
And and I think people are just interested to know the human side of these famous sportsmen.
The sportsmen underrated as interviewees.
Absolutely.
I mean, there were so many stereotypes, so many sketch shows have been based.
Of course, for The Guardian, I do their weekly sports interview, and so I'm doing sort of 46 famous sports people a year. And I'm not amazed because I'm used to it now, but I would say there's just a handful who this don't have much to offer. I would say 42 out of the 46 actually have quite an intelligence and an insight into their lives and wider society as well.
But there is increasingly such tight control over those sportsmen and women. And, you know, newspapers have to make agreements that, I will mention the boots that you put your name to.
I face this battle more and more because sponsors, you know, you can only get an interview with X person if you talk about their boot. But I think the important thing is never to give copy approval. And I've lost many interviews because the manager of the agent says, well, we want to see your copy before. I won't do that. And I always attempt to be positive in my interviews. But yeah, there is this desire to actually have a manufactured image of a sportsman. And actually what agents and managers don't understand, people feel more empathy if they see the wider human side of that sportsman more than the bland, perfect guy selling his shoes as well.
Yeah, you need to see the frailty in order to fall in love with the sportsman.
Yeah,
you know,
But it is a bit of a battle dealing with the agents and managers. But I'm winning a few of them.
Okay, good.
And just finally, what about the film rights? This would make an amazing film, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
that wasn't an offer, by the way.
That's not an offer. I don't have the power.
No, I think it would. Yeah, there's a few little snippets going on.
Sniffs around,
I think it is a fantastic subject.
Yeah.
You know, 1960s New York, we've got Jackie Kennedy going on and Bob Dylan singing about the death of a fighter in this book.
A lot of context again.
Absolutely. And it's a fascinating time. But we'll talk further about our movie plans.
We'll bring you back in a couple of years' time when it's about to be released. Donald McRae, thank you very much for joining us today. The book is A Man's World, The Double Life of Emile Griffith.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Time for some music now. This is new from those slowcore stalwarts from the US Midwest. It's Low with What Part of Me. That was Low with What Part of Me, and you're tuned in to The Monocle Weekly.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
Sebastian Faulks is an author whose canon of great works includes Birdsong, Charlotte Gray, and Human Traces. The former literary editor of The Independent is noted for stories that delve into the grey area of the flawed human mind amid events taking in some of the 20th century's bloodiest conflicts, and there's no shortage of drama there.
His latest book, Where My Heart Used to Beat, combines many of Faulks' signature strengths. Not only is it the tale of one man's lifetime, a psychiatrist of course, but also an analytical reflection of the 20th century that splits its jumping storyline between two world wars and locations across the globe. Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Sebastian a little earlier.
Let's talk about the new book, Where My Heart Used to Beat. It's an epic, but it's contained in the scope of one man's life. When you're writing a book of that scale, it's an obvious question, but where do you possibly start? What was the inspiration that kicked that off?
You say it's an epic, and I'm very happy with that. It's very a splendid term, and it gives some idea of the seriousness of the ideas it's trying to deal with. But of course, it's not really epic in length. It's only just over 300 pages long. And it wouldn't be really that long if the publishers hadn't put a lot of white space to make it easier to read. Really, most books have five or six different beginnings, ideas turning around in your head. And all the time that, unfortunately, it's a wonderful life being a writer, the only downside is that you're never off. You can never switch off. Because actually, even when you're on holiday, sometimes these ideas suddenly gel somehow in the back of your mind. But I think, really, it was watching the Queen and Tony Blair on the last night of the 20th century standing next to one another in the Millennium Dome, neither of them knowing quite what to do or what it was for or what it was all about. And I thought, ooh, that's rather good symbol of the 20th century, which is now coming to an end. And I thought the end of the 20th century was a much more interesting moment, really, than the end of the millennium, which is so long that it doesn't really have a character. So Where My Heart Used to Beat is really a book about the 20th century. What did it tell us about human beings, about Europeans, about ourselves, that this movement from the beginning of the century, the world of empire, to the end of the century, where we had essentially social democracy through Europe, that transition was made at the cost of the extermination of tens and hundreds of millions of people? And was that just because we had bad politics, bad leaders, bad faith, bad decisions? Or was there something really inevitable in the nature of the human animal, that once the means of mass killing were in our hands, we were always going to use them? So that's the sort of serious theme that sort of goes behind it. But then, as you say, it is, of course, seen through the experiences closely described, the intimate experiences of one man. And his life, I suppose you would say, is a rather 20th century life, because it is shaped by these wars, inevitably. But he also has, you know, he has a career, he has a life, he has a girlfriend, he has relationships with other women, and so on.
Seems like he's almost, although he's been through these extraordinary events and, you know, a couple of wars, he seems quite an everyday figure, just trying to work through it. How did you make that an appealing prospect for the reader? Is that really important to have that real sort of Joe Bloggs that people can identify with first while you're sort of colouring the story with all these incredible events around it?
Yes, I mean, he's quite strong meat, Hendricks. I mean, he starts out, the first scene in the book, he's ordering in a call girl to a flat in New York and treating her, I wouldn't say cruelly, but, you know, with a degree of indifference. And, you know, you don't immediately think this is a nice man. You think this is a man who's been bruised by experience. Mm. I don't really want you to like him. I don't really care whether you like him or not, but I want you to be interested in how he got to be this way, which is a fairly standard novelistic procedure, really. But yes, of course, it's important, I think, when you're taking the reader into extraordinary experiences like the ones that he has, Hendricks has, in the Second World War, both fighting in North Africa and then in Italy. You want to feel, this could be me. If I had been there, this is pretty much what I'd have felt as well. And you'd have felt the swell of the sea, and you'd been worried about getting your gun wet. Really, you'd be worrying before you went ashore at Anzio, is there some way I can hide from the German guns and without being spotted? You know, rather shameful thoughts like this.
As I read the book, the thing that really strikes me is, I mean, I know it's necessary to research any book, but it feels like a huge amount of research goes into these books, even from the sort of historical subtext. I mean, you've got this central character who's kind of a bit of a history buff himself, so he keeps resorting to kind of Napoleonic Wars and Greek tragedies and things like that. But also just even really small things like his wartime cricket team, and they all have a backstory. Are these stories that sort of you come across? Are these sort of stories that you steal from people you know? Or is this stuff that, you know, you really take a joy in just imagining from scratch?
It's the end, the last thing, take a joy in imagining from scratch. I mean, for instance, if you're going to have a peaceful and happy bit, you know, the reader needs a break, he needs a break. So after the evacuation from Dunkirk, he's back home and he's stationed in Devon. And, you know, I've played in a lot of different cricket teams, football teams, and I put together a team of his friends, all of whom are imagined characters, some of whom draw slightly on people I may have known, not in their names, but, you know, there's a left-arm spinner, you know, who's a bit like a boy I was at school with and so on. This is really the fun bit, and there's not very much research needed for all that. I mean, what I did need research for, though, is, for instance, the war in Italy, how long it would take him to drive from one place to another. And this has become a great, much more easy to do with the internet. So, I mean, first of all, I was looking at this town called Pozzuoli, where he's going to take his girlfriend. And they're starting off from somewhere near Naples. So I got the map out and I calculated the distance using the little scale at the bottom of the page. And I thought, hang on, this is the 21st century. So I Googled it, Google Maps, and the answer came up 27 minutes in current traffic conditions. So I thought, well, it's 1944. There's going to be even fewer cars on the road, so that's fine. But of course, a lot of the background of the 20th century history, I've sort of been into these areas before. And indeed, I lived during the 1960s, from sort of 60s on. The book is set in the 80s. That's all, you know, I can remember all that. I wouldn't like to think people reading this book would think, my goodness, this guy's done a heck of a lot of research, because that would mean that it hadn't been digested. And
right.
I hope it sounds natural.
It's interesting the premise you sort of mentioned about the end of the century and seeing Tony Blair and the Queen and stuff. I've sort of had this maybe quite weird thought to myself, because I was born in sort of 1982. And I always approached my life thinking, we're at the end of the century, we've learned a lot. Like I kind of felt like we had a lot of perspective. And then as soon as 2000 rolled around, I suddenly felt sort of like very small and junior in the century, you know, because I know that people at the end of this century will look back and think, what a bunch of idiots, why were they doing that? Yeah. And it's also kind of interesting that you kind of seized on the events at the beginning and sort of obviously all the way through, but starting with the sort of First World War in the last century. Do you think we're making some pretty monumental mistakes just in that way today as well?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I don't think novelists really should be telling people, you know, what to do and what to think. I think you can set out these ideas and these themes and you allow them in a fictional framework to sort of resonate, and the reader will think, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't seen it that way. Mm. But you're not setting out a mathematical proof and you're not telling people that's right, that's wrong, that's right, this is how we should behave. But I think that to some extent, if you see the response of the countries in Europe to the refugee crisis, for instance, and Germany sort of rather leading the way and the way that Germany conducts itself abroad these days, you think certainly some short-term simple political lessons have been learned. But obviously the new wars, the new violence in the Middle East and the extreme Islamist threat is a new thing. And the addition of religion, I mean, there haven't been religious wars. Of course, these are only partly religious. They're mostly about territory and yeah. self-determination. But that is a new sort of rogue ingredient.
Psychiatry is a theme that you revisit a lot in your books. Tell me about what it is that you think you're trying to say in this one from a psychiatry perspective that maybe you haven't said in another book.
Well, two things. One is the main character finds some redemption in his professional life. His personal life goes badly wrong. He's essentially orphaned. And then the love of his life, that comes to grief during the war in ways I won't explain. But he finds some redemption in attempting to cure people of quite severe psychiatric illnesses. So that's one function that it serves. And he makes an effort to talk to people who are really deranged, psychotic, and try to understand their experience, which is something that did happen in the 1960s with famous psychiatrists like R.D. Lang. And it hadn't really been done before, and it hasn't been done a great deal since, because it didn't really produce, you know, huge therapeutic benefits. But the other way in which the question of insanity comes into the book is the question of what kind of a creature is the human being. And looking at the 20th century and how, as I was saying, we move from one world to another in the course of that century, but only at the cost of killing hundreds of millions of our own kind. That tells you that we are a pretty strange creature, I think.
Right.
And I'm trying to look at what is this extraordinary lack of balance and purpose in Homo sapiens, and is it to do with the fact that we are so only quite recently evolved into the creature we are? Why is 1 in 100 of us psychotic, hearing voices? Why are we so unstable? So that's how that ties into the other themes of the book.
Do you think that we are a lot more unstable than, say, other species, animals on
yes.
the planet? Or do you think it's just that we have access to this ridiculous sort of, I mean, you can say intellect, but maybe it's a sort of a form of stupidity as well. But we have access to
a higher consciousness.
A lion will fight another lion in the Serengeti and just kill it, whereas we have access to huge armories of weapons, and that, and maybe that's why we sort of kill hundreds of millions of people rather than the animals that do that.
We don't know whether if a what's the word for lions, a collective of
lions? A pride of lions,
whether they had Zyklon B and, you know, chlorine gas and nuclear weapons, whether they would use it to exterminate all their competitors in the Serengeti, we don't know. But certainly, in my opinion, one of the reasons that we are so unstable is because the higher consciousness that we have is one of the last things that we acquired. I mean, the arms, the legs, the heart, lungs, liver, you know, the apes, our cousins and our forebears and our common ancestors had all those, and they work fine. It's a bit like we are like a German car, and the engine will do 200,000 miles fine, but the electronics go wrong very early, and that's the human, the Homo sapiens bit. It's just not bedded in yet.
It's quite a bold statement to make about the entire human race. So I'm just curious. Yeah. I mean,
well, you're clearly insane.
thank you very much. I'll take that as a compliment.
So am I.
But yeah, I mean, these books, they have so much sort of delving into the psyche and psychiatry itself. Do you get help with that? Do you do all that research yourself, or do you talk to medical professionals? And, you know, is there anything where you're kind of like, well, that was a bit of poetic license. It might not quite be clinically the gospel. How do you find that expertise and make it into a story?
Well, I spent about 5 years on this, writing Human Traces, early in about 10 years ago, during the course of which I spoke to a huge number of psychiatrists, doctors, psychologists, and indeed to patients. And I got a lot of insight from talking to patients. One or two of the ideas that are hypothesized by the characters in this book are right on the edge of what is feasible. But that's fine, because they are given to fictional characters, and I'm not saying they worked or could work or did happen. But anything that is said, is taken in the book to be agreed or a truth or something that is practiced and used, that should be factually correct, and that is double-checked.
You're very good at finding the style of other people's writing and sometimes incorporating it into your own work. I know that you've written a James Bond book in the past. Are there any writers coming up at the moment who you read that you're just actually really excited about to see what they're going to be producing next?
Oh, my mind always goes completely blank when I'm asked this question. Can I think of an exciting young writer? Well, I mean, I think David Mitchell is an incredibly talented guy. I mean, though, as you say, I mean, he's someone who writes in many, many different voices. Mm. The secret of writing is that every book you write actually has a distinctive voice, and Where My Heart Used to Beat is written in the first person. So I'm trying to hear a man's voice and give him a voice which is accurate to him. But also, I mean, even if you're writing in the third person, you still need to find a tone of voice which is appropriate for the period in which it's set, the kind of engagement you're trying to make with the author. And that's really the hardest thing about writing a novel, is getting the first page right.
Yeah.
And once you've got that tone, you're away. But probably I wrote the first page of this 50 times.
Yeah.
And then, but by the time I was, the last chapter, you know, I was flying, so.
Is the first page always the first page, or is it something that you come to late in the process?
No, with me, it's always the first page, but I can see why you might want to change it. I remember as a schoolboy years ago writing essays, and I wouldn't put the title on until I'd seen what it was about, and then I'd put a very precise title, which was incredibly irrelevant to what was coming, and then I might often slip in a new paragraph at the front. But I don't do that with books, no. You start at the beginning.
One of the things I found particularly appealing about the main character in this book is that he almost grows into the character as you read the book, because at the beginning it's almost like we don't know what he looks like, we don't know who he is, like we don't know anything about him, and as the book goes on it feels very much like the reader is sort of becoming him, if you know what I mean, which I thought was a clever device, rather than being like he has blonde hair and he does this and he's a doctor and all this.
Well, I hope you get to know him in the way that you get to know real people in real life, when you see them in different circumstances and see how they respond to things, and there suddenly becomes a moment at which they become known to you and to some extent predictable to you. You say, well, we can't drive up there with so-and-so and so-and-so because Joe will hate that, because he'll be anxious because of that. And that's when people have become predictable, because you know them. But at the same time, I think in fiction, you don't want your character to become too rounded and too predictable. It's important sometimes that they should do things out of character, oddly enough.
The book is Where My Heart Used to Be. Sebastian Foulkes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Tom Hall talking to Sebastian Foulkes a little earlier.
The new October issue of Monocle delivers our well-turned-out style and retail survey that looks beyond the surface to discover the people and ideas shaping this world for the better. But there's so much more in our new issue.
In the design section, we take a tour of three poignant memorials and talk to architect Daniel Liebeskind about how design can help bring meaning to tragedy.
In the edit section, we sip apple brandy in America's oldest distillery, beat a path to a once bawdy neighborhood we like in Zurich, and meet creative director extraordinaire John Jay in Portland for his hypothetical last meal.
The Monocle October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining us as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Now we've dipped into some pretty fluffy subjects here and there on the Monocle Weekly over the years. It is Sunday, we're allowed to. But our final item on today's show possibly sits above all others. Gavin Pretorpini is the creator of the Cloud Appreciation Society, which is 10 years old this month and has a membership of around 40,000 people who take joy in looking skywards.
As well as being co-founder of the Idler magazine, that regular ode to a life lived without making hard work of things, Gavin has written a number of cloud spotters books dedicated to better documenting these most evanescent of earthly features. And to celebrate 10 years spent with his head in the clouds, this Saturday, the Cloud Appreciation Society conference will take place at London's Royal Geographical Society with a selection of guest speakers and interactive workshops. And he's on the line now to tell us more. Gavin, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, thanks for coming on the programme. And what is the sort of exact chair? What is your favoured way of gazing at the clouds?
Well, I don't know. You could lie down on your back in a park. I mean, that's always
a classic.
That is a classic, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Especially for a cumulus cloud day, which is the cumulus clouds, the fluffy cotton wool clouds, you know, you see it at the beginning of The Simpsons. Those ones are good ones for finding shapes in, which of course is a good activity when you're lying on your back in the park. So I guess that's as good a time as any.
Nice. And just the sort of subtext to the Cloud Appreciation Society, is it to try to sort of say, tell people that every cloud has a silver lining, that you know, that we should appreciate the things that sometimes bring us shade, sometimes bring us rain, as much as the scorching sunshine, which we very rarely get?
Well, that's right. I mean, I do think that happiness doesn't come from wishing you were somewhere else the whole time. We live in a country where we have varied skies, we have wet summers. August is one of the wettest months. We have a lot of beauty and variety in the sky. And my point is, let's appreciate that rather than wishing we lived in Southern California where we had monotonous blue skies day after day after day.
You say we've got variety, and you mentioned the cumulus cloud earlier. Couldn't you take us through some of your sort of more underrated favourites?
Ooh, which clouds are underrated? Well, I mean, firstly, let's just discount the ones that are correctly kind of disliked, all right? So you've got the nimbostratus, the grey, overcast, Tupperware sky that rains and rains and rains, just featureless over the whole sky. I agree with others. This isn't a great cloud to celebrate. But the point is, don't let that one give all the others a bad name, all right? How about the lenticularis cloud? So this
One's that?
It is one that forms around mountains, and it often looks like a UFO, flying saucer. It's a kind of disc of cloud, smooth disc of cloud. It doesn't have to be mountains. When the conditions are right, you can see them downwind of just some hills. And the way it works is that the wind has to rise to pass over the hill, and in the lee of the hill or the mountain, the lee of the peak, it can, in some conditions, kind of rise and dip and rise and dip the flow of air in these kind of waves. They're like standing waves of air. They don't travel along like a wave on the ocean. They stay in place with the air flowing through. And one of these clouds, these lenticularis clouds, named after the Latin for a lentil, can appear like a disc, a flying saucer on the top of the invisible wave of air. Those are beauties.
We talked about the event that's happening at the Royal Geographical Society. What sort of people are cloud spotters, Gavin? Is it the sort of many and varied, multi-hued crowd that you would desire? Or is there a certain type of thermos-carrying cloud spotter?
Yeah, well, like, you know, I do try to seek out the thermos-carrying cloud spotters, but you get all sorts, unfortunately. I mean, you know, in terms of our membership, there are a slight kind of emphasis on females over males. And we have a real range of ages, from a few months when people buy membership to the Cloud Appreciation Society as a sort of gift for a godchild, right up to 96, I think, is our oldest. And we also get a very big range of relationships with the sky from our members. We have a few who are meteorologists who deal with the weather in a professional capacity, but the vast majority are people who probably don't even know the different names of the different clouds. And they are also quite often people who have an interest in the cloud that's not scientific, it's perhaps artistic. So maybe they are into painting, and they know that, just as John Constable, one of Britain's greatest cloud painters, said that the sky is the chief organ of sentiment, the keynote in his landscapes, i.e. it's the bit that brings the feeling. And that's why he spent so much time on Hampstead Heath. 2 years he spent practicing the clouds. He didn't bother in 1822 to 24, didn't bother with the land at all. He just did cloud studies. So people who are artists appreciate that fact, that the importance of the sky in a painting. So you get, you know, scientists, cloud physicists, you get artists, you get people who just remember when they were young, looking up, finding shapes in the clouds, and they have this deep down affection. They're kind of, they harbour this affection towards the clouds. They kind of complain about someone having a cloud hanging over them or a cloud on the horizon, just like everyone else does. But when you stop them and you ask, what do you think about the sky? You find there are a lot of people who say, actually, you know, they kind of admit to this nostalgic fondness that they harbour for them. So, you know, it's all types.
And it's part of the reason for having these sorts of events, in a sense, a way of reminding people that they are, that they're not alone, that, you know, cloud spotting can be a bit of a lonely activity, or a solo activity, perhaps we should put it more like that rather than lonely. And by having events like this, you're showing that actually it's it could be more of a, more like group fun.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I mean, this is the first time, so the Cloud Appreciation Society has been going 10 years, as I think you said. This is the first time I've got around to organising one. It's not like I've done a lot. We had kind of local gatherings with people, and I've been to events that members have organised. But this is the first time we've had a big official Cloud Appreciation Society event, and it's certainly not just for members of the Cloud Appreciation. It's for anyone who shares the view that we have, which is that the sky and the clouds are the most evocative, dynamic, even poetic aspect of nature. So it is, you know, it's good to get people together in this internet age. We're very much a society of the internet age, in the sense that people are brought together from all over the world. We've got members in 106 countries. They're brought together by a shared interest. That's very kind of internet, isn't it? But the flip side of a society like that is that it's membership is kind of very disparate. It was like a cloud, really. There's no kind of centre to it. It's spread everywhere. And so I do think, as a counter to the fact that we all have friends, in inverted commas, and acquaintances that we've never met online, it's nice to actually bring people together. And that's really the kind of motivation behind doing this.
Gavin, can we, I'm sure you know your stuff. I wonder whether we could just sort of test your knowledge, yes, your crowd knowledge,
go
a little bit
it.
More. I'll mention a type of cloud and you can describe it to us. How does that sound?
Okay.
Tell us about the mammatus.
Well, you pronounced it wrong.
Oh.
Mammatus. I mean, it's also officially known as mumma. Mammatus is actually an older term. Now, mumma, the name is the Latin for udders. And these are like kind of pouches, all right, that hang on the underside of a cloud layer, mumma, also known as mammatus. They hang on the underside of a cloud layer, can look very, very dramatic when the sun is low in the sky and casting shadows across them. And the most pronounced and buxom mumma clouds are the ones that form on the underside of the anvil of a storm cloud. Storm clouds are those kind of mushroom clouds that spread outwards at the top. In some conditions, on the underside of that spreading out anvil at the top of a storm cloud, you can see dramatic mumma.
Do you want to do that? Give Gavin another one?
Yeah, go on then. One more, and hopefully I'll get the pronunciation right on this one. Aspiratus clouds.
Yes, well, that was pretty good, except for the fact that the name has changed for that as well.
Oh, no. What is it now?
This, interestingly, is... This is the cloud that the cloud classification that has come out of the Cloud Appreciation Society. So 8 years ago, some people sent in some photographs from the States of these weird wavy clouds that look like kind of a contorted sea. They look like a turbulent contorted sea. And I didn't quite know how to classify them. They didn't fit in with the existing terms. Every now and then someone would send us another example from somewhere else around the world. And we got them every sort of 6 months, every year, until eventually I said, you know, look, maybe we need a new classification of cloud. Maybe if these don't fit within the existing terms, the existing names, maybe they need a name of their own. So this then started as a very slow process, because the people who decide on cloud classification are the World Meteorological Organization in Geneva. They're a UN organization. They don't do anything in a hurry. Everything moves at a glacial pace. And the reason they decide is because they publish the official book, the International Cloud Atlas, geekiest book in the world. It's not a page turner. And it is the one that includes all the listings of all the different classifications of clouds. To be official, you've got to be in that. They have just announced within the last year that they're going to be putting a new edition of this out in 2016, next year. And they have finally, after a lot of kind of negotiations and thinking about it, decided to accept this that we propose. It's a bit of citizen science, really, coming out of the society. They accept this as a new classification of clouds. They slightly tweaked the name to Asperitas. Means roughness. The one I proposed means roughened, but they've changed it to roughness. So they wanted it to be a noun because of the type of classification it's becoming. And they're saying that it's going to be included and added into the International Cloud Atlas. So it will be the first new type of cloud since 1951.
Wow. And just finally, where do you go on holiday? To see, I don't know whether you search for the spotless skies of Southern California or whether you want to go somewhere really awful. I mean, or beautiful. I mean,
well, the thing is, actually, I don't associate holidays and going places with cloud spotting, funnily enough. I just found a long time ago, if you go somewhere to see interesting clouds, they don't happen. That's the thing about clouds. They don't do what you want them to. Do you know what I mean? It's also one of the appeals about them, that they, you know, the chaotic nature of the sky and of the atmosphere means that you can't predict or plan. So being a cloud spotter is not about going somewhere to spot clouds. It's not about saying, this weekend I'm going to go and spot clouds up in Cumbria. It's about having a frame of mind and an attitude. You can see amazing, beautiful, interesting, exotic clouds and exotic cloud formations wherever you are, you know, from your back garden. If you're in a city, if you live in an inner city, then the sky is the last wilderness available to you. And you can see, do great cloud spotting from the top of a high rise. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't matter where you are. It's about a frame of mind. And it's about being prepared when you notice something in the sky. When you just glance up and remember to glance up and notice something in the sky, it's being prepared to stop what you're doing and take a few moments to appreciate it, to pay attention to it, and then let it go.
What beautiful, poetical, philosophical stuff it is. Gavin Pretor-Pinney from the Cloud Appreciation Society, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem. It's great to speak to you.
And there we have it, Steve. I would have said that in the pantheon of shows, that was quite a good one. Let down, really, by Daniel Giacopelli's News Look Ahead.
It was
boisterous at best, silly at worst.
Yes. Well, although, having said that, I mean, that is what you want from a News Look Ahead.
I think there should be more of the... Do you think there should be more of the News Look Ahead in the pages of Monocle magazine, in the affairs section, for example? Could there be a section on lawnmower racing?
I feel like it is an untapped market for us. I think, actually, that should be next month's expo.
Yeah,
lawnmower race.
To be honest,
if you flick through the new issue, you know, there is an expo there, which is, I wouldn't necessarily say it's akin to lawnmower racing, but it is a curious sport which says something about a certain country.
It is up there, isn't it?
It is.
It's up there in the hills.
It's very much there in the hills. I'm not here next week. I think Andrew is back.
Is he? Is it? It's all musical chairs again, is it?
It's all musical chairs. I'm in Ukraine next week.
Are you?
Yeah.
What on earth is going on there?
I am, I can't quite say, actually. It's really? For an interview.
You're having an affair.
just can't tell anyone what's happening in Ukraine.
I can't really tell you what's happening there.
Yeah. But you can read all about it in December, January. I mean, Rob, I can tell you afterwards.
Okay.
But everyone else, I'm afraid. You can read all about it in December, January.
There nice we one. Well, that's it. That is edition 324 of the Monocle Weekly.
Wakely?
Wakely, sorry. I'm feeling slightly funereal on my way back from holiday. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. And we're back same time, same place, where we'll be speaking to none other than rock photography aristocracy, Mick Rock. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.